Welcome to the World of Intelligence, a podcast for you to discover the latest analysis of global military and security trends within the open source defense intelligence community. Now onto the episode with your host, Harry Kemsley.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of Jane's World of Intelligence. Your host, Harry Kemsley, and unusually, I don't have Sean Corbett, my co-host, with me today, but we'll press on regardless. Today, I'd like to cover the situation that has now developed from the situation in the Middle East with Israel and Lebanon, and specifically the incursion into southern Lebanon in the recent days. And for that, I am very, very pleased to welcome back two previous guests to this podcast, Elliot Chapman. Hello, Elliot.
Hi, Harry. Thanks for having me back.
Pleasure, as always. And Suraj Ghanasan. Hello, Suraj.
Hi, Harry. Good to be back.
Thank you very much for taking the time to join me again. If you are interested in the bios of either Elliot or Garage, that gives you some idea of the provenance of them talking on this really, really important topic, please look into the link that you will have come through to see their bios there. So, Suraj, perhaps you can do the audience to this podcast episode the benefit of a quick overview of what are the main events that we've seen in recent times that have created the situation that we're watching with some horror over the recent days.
Yeah, sure, Harry. A lot has happened in the last 2 months, and in the interest of time, I'm just going to try and cover this as quickly as possible. I think the current hostilities can be traced back to the killing of the senior Hezbollah commander Fuad Shukr in Dahiye on 30th July. Hezbollah retaliated to his killing almost 1 month later on 25th August by firing about 200 to 300 projectiles on IDF positions in northern Israel. An important aspect about this retaliation was that shortly before the Hezbollah retaliation, the IDF conducted what it described as preemptive strikes in southern and central Lebanon, including in Bekaa Valley, against Hezbollah targets, including rocket launchers and infrastructures. And the Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, also stated that they destroyed about 50 to 65% of Hezbollah munitions during these preemptive strikes. So subsequently, since 1st September, Jane's recorded at least a 30% increase in Hezbollah attack claims. And it also recorded, at least an equal increase in IDF airstrikes in Bekaa and central and northern Lebanon. But perhaps, among the ongoing hostilities, the first severe blow to Hezbollah capabilities was on the 17th and 18th September, when Israeli operations resulted in explosions of Hezbollah pagers and handheld radios, killing at least 32 people, including civilian and Hezbollah militants, and wounding at least 3,200 others, including the Iranian ambassador to Lebanon, Mojtaba Amani. This operation severely undermined Hezbollah's security apparatus. It also very likely disrupted its control and command and communications capabilities while driving shock, confusion, and paranoia amongst the group members. Another important aspect to note was the operation also very likely showed us that Israel is not deterred by the threat of a Hezbollah retaliation and felt that it can preemptively strike Hezbollah while preparing for a larger attack. That was very likely adopted by Israel following the 25th August Hezbollah retaliation to Fuad Shukr's killing. Subsequently, on 20th September, Hezbollah fired at least 290 projectiles on IDF positions, following the 17th and 18th Israeli operation. To this firing of 290 projectiles, the IDF retaliated by killing the Redwan unit commander, Ibrahim Akil, in Beirut. On 22nd September, Hezbollah fired the Fadi-1 and Fadi-2 missiles. And also on 25th September, it fired the Qadr-1 missile. The three missiles that I named just now were not fired since October. So these were the first instances, when Hezbollah fired these missiles and were part of a policy that was often touted by Nasrallah, stating that if Israel Israel were to increase its operations in southern Lebanon, Hezbollah would appropriately increase the scope of its targets and weapons used against Israel. But the second blow after the 17th and 18th operations from the IDF came since the 23rd September. From 23rd to 30th September, the IDF struck at least 2,000 targets across Lebanon. These the Hezbollah assets, such as rocket launchers, short, medium, and long-range missile capabilities, military infrastructure, weapons depot, and intelligence apparatus. They were all located in southern Lebanon, Bekaa Valley, and regions north of Beirut. These airstrikes, coupled with the ones on 21st September, they caused significant damage to Hezbollah's combat capabilities and its command and control structure. Among these airstrikes, the most significant one was conducted on 27th September, when IDF airstrikes targeted Hezbollah Central Command headquarters located underground in southern Beirut suburbs of Dahiyeh, killing the group's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah and at least 20 other senior Hezbollah advisors and commanders, including Ali Karaki, the commander of Hezbollah's southern front. So since then, at least since 30th September and ongoing, We've noted a lot of IDF statements and local media reports about what IDF stated as limited, localized, and targeted ground raids against Hezbollah militants and infrastructure in southern Lebanon. In fact, on 1st October, the IDF announced that they targeted about 70 Hezbollah sites, including tunnels, weapon sites, and other infrastructure, all of these running up to 10 kilometers into the Lebanese territory.
That's a very thorough and very complete resume. Thank you very much, Siraj, indeed. Just one point, going back to something you said earlier. Do we have any evidence that proves that the pagers and radio communications devices that exploded were by Israel? Is there anything in the open source that gives us some confirmation of that? Because I don't recall ever hearing that that was confirmed by the Israeli forces. Do we have anything from open source that, I know it's most likely, but do we have anything that gives us some justification for that assertion?
Well, we haven't, like you mentioned, Israel has not claimed responsibility for these operations. And we at Jane's also assessed that it was Israel that was very likely behind these pager explosions, because, we have some precedent to this. In 1996, Israel killed Hamas bomb maker Yahya Ayash using an exploding mobile phone. And they've also conducted several such operations since. So, using these examples, we are able to ascertain to a certain amount of confidence, medium to high level of confidence, that Israel was indeed behind these operations.
Very good. Elliot, I know that you've got a fair degree of understanding of IDF from your own work. What's your thoughts on this assertion that it's the IDF behind them?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to be kind of cut and dry about exactly, and we may never know as well who's ultimately conducted this operation. But sure. I think there is some there's some evidence, I think, that sort of is tangential to this, which shows that it could be the Israelis. One perhaps notable piece is that it's essentially it appears that it's an Israeli affiliated contractor that manufactured the devices that were subsequently issued to Hezbollah and also, Hezbollah affiliated people as well.
That would be very interesting to look at that on another time, just to examine how the open source environment is no doubt looking very closely at that particular operation. I mean, to go, Siraj, to your point, I suspect the psychological impact of that set of activities in the minds of the Hezbollah operatives must have been very, very significant indeed. Has there been any suggestion that it has created the kind of confusion and panic that you might have assumed that it would create? Have you seen any indications of that within Hezbollah communications at all?
Well, actually, there's been a lot of reports which we cannot verify, of course, but, they've been saying local Israeli media has been indicating that there was some sort of disagreement between, various leaders of the senior command of Hezbollah on how to retaliate for this, especially because the IDF was very likely able to infiltrate Hezbollah's communication capabilities. And I think a very important point to note was, since October, the IDF has had had, you know, notable success in taking out senior Hezbollah commanders, tracking them through their usage of mobile phones and other communication devices. And as a result, Nasrallah has several times come out and said or urged Hezbollah militants to not use mobile phones and rather shift to, you know, older forms of communication, so to speak, like pagers and such. And, you know, considering that Israel was able to conduct, Israel was very likely able to conduct such a widespread operation targeting Hezbollah pagers, it's, you know, it's quite likely that this has caused a certain amount of confusion.
Yeah, from a lot of years ago, from my own time in the Middle East, I remember talking a great deal about the so-called Arab street, which is this notion that a lot of the communications traditionally has been done verbally in and around coffee shops and buildings and organizations of that sort. But before we get too deep into that particular conversation, I'll come back to you in just a second, Siraj, in terms of the operational capabilities that we think the southern area of Lebanon still has in terms of tunnels and bunkers. Elliot, let me come to you, though, in terms of the perspective now, looking at the Israeli side of this conversation. The raiding into southern Lebanon, what are they doing there? What do you think the overall mission is, the goal of that mission they're doing?
So I think it's essentially to push back Hezbollah's capabilities, which it's military capabilities, which are more or less up until this point have been sort of at the border itself. So a sort of situation where there is zero depth to Israel's kind of defensive posture towards southern Lebanon and Hezbollah. And that, of course, has meant that, you know, the weapons that Hezbollah has at its disposal, which are kind of, you know, principally things like 20-kilometer range or 10-kilometer range ATGMs or up to and sort of 20-kilometer range unguided rockets, that's creating this effect that there is a kind of bubble of insecurity in northern Lebanon, that there is no option really for the Israelis other than to evacuate its communities that are right up against the Lebanese border and really dig down and kind of create a defensive position. So right. I think what Israel is trying to do is to flip that situation and create some depth on right. The other side of its border by targeting Hezbollah's military capabilities that are the closest really to and therefore the greatest threat to
taking some of those short range somewhat unguided systems out of the game by pushing that almost like a buffer zone. And I think you said northern Lebanon, you meant southern Lebanon or northern Israel.
Northern Israel, southern Lebanon.
So just before we go much further into the Israeli part of this conversation in terms of the kind of missions that they're conducting with whom, which I'd love to come back to, you know, I'd like to also understand in a minute, Elliot, just how big an operation this is. Is this small targeted operations or is actually there evidence on the ground that shows that this is much, much bigger than that or should soon be much bigger? But I'll come back to that point. Let me just come back to you, Siraj, then. So we've seen this attempt from the Israelis in terms of pushing back, trying to create this buffer zone to take some of these shorter range weapon systems out of the game. What's left in terms of operational capabilities, though, from what we understand? Have we got any indications from open sources that gives us some sense of what actually is left in terms of Hezbollah capabilities in this southern area?
Well, unfortunately, not really. You know, your open sources have not indicated the actual results of the, you know, Israeli airstrikes that have taken place since at least 21st September. We don't know how much. While we assess that it's very likely a lot of Hezbollah capabilities, weapons capabilities have been degraded, we don't know the exact extent of you know, the degradation of such capabilities, especially because despite all of these Israeli airstrikes, Hezbollah militants along the Lebanon-Israel border continue to fire projectiles into northern Israel. Since at least 1st September, we've recorded, like I mentioned earlier, a 30% increase in the projectiles. Just to give a perspective, before 1st September, it was about 55 attack claims per week. But now we are recording at least 75 to 85 attack claims per week, even continuing right now amidst the ongoing Israeli incursion. So, you know, that shows that Hezbollah still retains, you know, much of its capabilities probably in terms of of fighting against the incoming Israeli forces into southern Lebanon.
So, Elliot, just coming back to you then, thank you, Suraj. In terms of looking at the Israeli mission that's underway, very interested to know if you've seen anything from an Israeli perspective about what they assess has been their impact, but equally the scale of the mission, the operation, you know, what units are being used. Is that, and through that part of the conversation, something I'd like to talk about in a moment from an Israeli perspective is this war on almost two fronts, the two axes now that are in play. They're clearly related geopolitically, but just because there are two fronts now, is there likely to be an impact in terms of their ability to support the two fronts? But going back to where I started, who's involved? How big an operation is this? And what can we see from an IDF perspective about their effectiveness thus far in this buffer zone they're trying to create?
I think to start us off, maybe I want to touch on some of Suraj's points he just made What we're sort of seeing is almost like there are different echelons of Hezbollah as an organization that are being impacted by different sort of levels of Israel's attacks. So, you know, the attacks in Beirut are kind of, you know, including the pager attacks, if it was Israel, but definitely the airstrikes that we've seen, you know, that is causing damage to its commands, you know, sort of central command and control systems. We're seeing the expansion of the airstrikes across Lebanon, including sort of the Bekaa Valley region, northern and southern Bekaa Valley, which borders Syria. So that's the kind of the rear echelon of the organization where much of its logistics capabilities are located. It's kind of real, it's a real depth. It's also its supply line routes in from Syria over land. And then there is the kind of the front line fighting kind of main force of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, which falls under the command of its southern command, as Suraj mentioned. That appears to be as a kind of front hardened to a lot of Israeli airstrikes, and what we're seeing from Israel's kind of what it's seeking to do with these targeted raids is going after hardened underground infrastructure that typically is, you know, resistant to airstrikes or otherwise very expensive and difficult to locate and destroy with airstrikes. So it would seem that actually to some degree, perhaps Israel's operations so far might have had a significant impact on its headquarters and kind of logistics and rear echelons. However, its front line, which operates, you know, as we understand, in kind of guerrilla sort of cell-based formations, that is perhaps a little less difficult to see that it's been clearly degraded by Israeli capabilities. Certainly, Israel's shown us sort of a lot of overground strikes that their airstrikes have been targeting, but I think clearly with the kind of undertaking of a ground offensive. Mm-hmm. In the scale that we're seeing, it is a kind of admission that actually airstrikes can only achieve so much, yeah. And that what they need to do is go in, locate sort of weapons caches, fighting positions, command and control bunkers, sort of season and destroy them essentially. I might have got a little off track, but
that's good. And I want to come back, Suraj, to you on a particular point there that I think is within that answer that Elias just described. You know, this echelons of Hezbollah. There is an assumption in many, certainly Western doctrine, that you take out the command and control, you break down the communications between the echelons, you degrade the effectiveness and the force. Is Hezbollah likely to be as vulnerable to the degrading of those echelons and the communication systems as we might be assuming? Now, that's a big assumption on my part. The Israelis see it that way. I suspect they're very, very familiar with how Hezbollah operates. But is there likely to be as much impact as we might expect by degrading command and control levels, communications lines, and lower, as Elliot described, as a guerrilla group tactics at the front line in the south? Is that likely to have as much impact as we'd like to see, or the Israelis would like to see?
Well, I think way to answer that question is, you know, coming back to Elliot's points, in southern Lebanon, the Hezbollah units are actually organized, or Hezbollah militants are actually organized into smaller units, whose commanders have a certain level of autonomy. This right. is something they've you know, learned and adapted since the 2006 Israel-Lebanon war. And, you know, like I mentioned, these commanders have a certain level of autonomy, and they're able to conduct attacks on their own to a certain extent. So that's another big reason why you're seeing that a lot of these you know, units in the Southern Command are able to hold and create casualties among Israeli forces. I think as of 3rd September, we've already seen some casualties, especially on 2nd September, when a small unit of Hezbollah militants ambushed an incoming, IDF unit. But yeah, there is very likely a certain level of degradation in terms of command and control, especially because the IDF has been targeting a lot of Hezbollah commanders since October. There's very likely to be a degradation in the central command structure, so to say. Yeah. So it's unlikely, that Hezbollah would be able to carry out a sustained, confrontation with Israel over the long term. They would require that central command structure to come back into play. But for now, in the immediate to short term, it's quite likely that the units in the Southern Command would be able to hold themselves.
Yeah, so let me just come back to you on that part. Thank you, Suraj. Elliot, the likelihood is that from almost 20 years ago, when there was a similar situation generated by different circumstances, of course, that both sides will have been preparing for this kind of environment. So you'd expect the Israeli forces to have been spending a great deal of time worrying about things like ambush, and that the hardened environment that they're going to be working into, and indeed the Hezbollah fighters anticipating the armored thrust, etc., that you've talked about. To what extent do you see any evidence, however, that they have learned from it, that there is perhaps less casualties from the Israelis than they might have other? Is there anything that we can give us any credence to this idea that the operations are as expected, being successful or otherwise?
Yeah, I think actually, and this comes back to an earlier point about kind of the what you mentioned, which is the creation of a buffer zone, and this kind of, you know, the idea that Israel is kind of going in to sort of, yeah, conduct a kind of large ground offensive. Actually, we're not seeing a large ground offensive. And in 2006, there was almost this kind of manic rush to generate kind of this offensive capability to activate reserves and go and push in to kind of conduct a sort of almost a retaliatory offensive to conditions. I think what we're seeing is casualties aside, perhaps a much more smaller, targeted, perhaps systematic, intelligence driven operation from the Israeli side, although we're seeing, you know, it is sort of at kind of a two division size operation. It's two, let's say, you know, colloquially perhaps a two small divisions that are being used here, so not a massive operation. And for context, you know, what we saw in Gaza, in northern Gaza alone, were three very sort of heavily armed and armored divisions rolling into Gaza across three axes. That's not really what we're seeing in southern Lebanon at this time. There is, of course, scope to kind of ratchet up the size of this operation. This we could be seeing the initial kind of preliminary probing operations to something that larger that may come later. But
we're shaping. So, in a moment, I'll come back to this point in just a second, but just to sort of give you some preparation time, if you will. As ever with this podcast, we're always keen to understand how we do what we do. And you've given both of you have given some really clear insights in terms of what you think is happening, the effect is happening, and so on. So in a minute, I'd like to come back to you and ask you both independently, what are you using to get these insights? What kind of information are you drawing, and how are you verifying it sufficiently for you to make the assertions that you're making? However, before we come to that question, let's just step back a second and look at where we are today and where do we think we're going to be in the foreseeable future? Foreseeable measured perhaps hours, days, weeks. I don't know. That's for you to quantify. Where's this going? Where's it going from Hezbollah's perspective? And Siraj, as I come to you with that question first, and I'll come to you in a moment, Elliot, from an Israeli perspective, I'm reflecting back on what you just said about the sustainability as we break down this hierarchical environment, the front line operating in guerrilla units, somewhat autonomously, you said, you know, how long can that continue? How effective is that going to be in the longer term? Is there likely to be a point of time where that starts to become less and less effective from his perspective? Let me start with that with you from your perspective, Siraj. Where's this going? What's the situation going to look like in a period of time ahead?
It's slightly difficult to ascertain where exactly this is going. Like I mentioned, we still don't know the exact scale and scope of the ongoing Israeli operation into southern Lebanon. IDF statements in the last couple of days sent out evacuation orders to at least 20 villages and towns in southern Lebanon to evacuate. And, they're asking the civilians to evacuate further north of the Litani River. It's called the Abali River, which is slightly north of the Litani River. So, I'm not suggesting that that's going to be the area that IDF is going to cover in terms of the operations, but it's hard to ascertain. In terms of your questions regarding the sustainability of Hezbollah militants, I think in the immediate term, at least, they're going to be able to hold on. They have enough weapons caches, hidden in various villages and towns and also underground, like Elliot pointed out earlier. They're also highly adapted to fight in this terrain. They're able to conduct ambushes, various other forms of attacks. For example, they have pneumatic lifts coming from underground to carry out rocket attacks on IDF positions or ADGM attacks. And, online reporting shows that, and also research from the 2006 Israel-Lebanon war shows that these pneumatic lifts are operated anywhere between 20 to 25 seconds to fire, rockets and missiles at Israeli positions. For now, they have enough weapons cache to hold their own against incoming Israeli forces, but in the immediate term. But, it's hard to ascertain, even in the short to medium term, where this is going.
Sure. Very good. Elliot, what's your thoughts about the Israeli half of this equation? Where's this likely going from their perspective?
Yeah, I think the Israeli perhaps approach is maybe reliant on some of the things that Siraj has just said, that if, maybe to expand on one of those things is that, the top echelons of the organization that have been killed so far do represent a kind of really long built body of knowledge for the organization, lots of personal connections, lots of leverage with its kind of allies and partners. And so we're seeing perhaps a breaking down of the linkages with its strategic partners in one way. So that's a kind of long-term perhaps sort of thing that we'll see manifest. It's not going to manifest immediately, as Siraj is saying, in kind of tactical outcomes on the ground. But it may be that in several years, the ability for Hezbollah to regenerate its capabilities has been severely undermined over the next sort of few years,
right.
By attacking these senior commanders. And so I guess from the Israeli perspective is that's This offensive is kind of a fundamental change from defense to offense in terms of its war, and I think Israel really considers its confrontation in Gaza with Iran, with Hezbollah, all linked. It's one conflict and
right.
with multiple fronts, and so now that it has kind of achieved more or less freedom of action in the Gaza Strip. To some degree, that it is now able to kind of flip and go on the offensive in its northern
right.
theatre.
Right.
I think in terms of the impacts that at least these small operations that we're seeing, if this is the limited scope of events, then I think the impact in the long term is not going to be very significant. But if these operations continue to expand, I think we'll see potentially some more significant long-term impacts on tactical capabilities. The ability for Israel to expand its operations is something that we're kind of monitoring closely. It's not obvious that Israel would want to, for example, call up hundreds of thousands of reserves to conduct a kind of Gaza clearing operation style offensive in southern Lebanon at this time. Yeah. So lots of unknowns, but I think, there's some answers there.
What I'd like to do, apologies, Siraj, I've just thought of something else I want to touch on, because we often forget about this when we talk about military operations, which is the impact on civilian populations, particularly, of course, in southern Lebanon and the border into Syria. I'll come back to you just in a moment on that. And Elliot, when we've done that, I will go to the next topic that I said it would, which is about, so how do we do this? What are the ways we're actually monitoring, assessing this from an open source perspective? So Siraj, what are we seeing in terms of impact on the civilian population in southern Lebanon from this series of incursions by Israeli forces?
Well, since the incursions, in terms of displacement, there hasn't been a lot of information. What we already know is that since October, there's been several hundred thousands displaced.
As many as that? Hundreds of thousands?
Yeah. 700,000 displaced. And if actually more recently, since the Israeli, accelerated air campaign across Lebanon since at least 23rd September, we know at least several hundred civilian casualties have occurred by open media source reporting. Of course, we've not been able to verify this. And we also don't know, unlike Israel, we also don't know how many communities across southern Lebanon have been evacuated. The IDF at least has released statements, saying how many communities they have asked to evacuate, in northern Israel. But in southern Lebanon, the IDF can issue statements ordering evacuation of civilian communities in southern Lebanon, but we actually don't know how many of these have been evacuated. And, in a recent report on Southern Command that Elliot and I published, we know that within the 10-kilometer threat zone along the Israel-Lebanon border into southern Lebanon, there are about 103 significant distinct urban areas that cover approximately 121 square kilometer area over there in southern Lebanon. So with the incursion, we're not exactly sure, but I think there's already been about 20 civilian casualties, but I think that's less. It ought to be a little more than that, considering that there's been hostilities reported in a number of different towns and villages in southern Lebanon. But this is what we know from open source reporting.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting to find out where they've gone. I mean, presumably, if they're going back into Syria, some of them are ex of Syria, of course, coming out of Syria into Lebanon, are now perhaps returning to their former homes, as difficult as that might be. Before we get
interject, Harry. I think that's a good point you raised about displacement into Syria, because I read some Israeli sources stating that from the 23rd to 25th, when the Israeli air campaign started in southern Lebanon, at least 30,000 civilians were stated as moving between Lebanon and Syria. From southern Lebanon and also Beirut all the way to Syria. So again, we're not able to verify these figures, but
sure, thank you for that. So Elliot, as we now start to bring this episode towards a close, let's finish by talking about methodologies, where we're getting the open source from and how we're verifying it.
I think I sort of see it as a kind of, I guess, hierarchy of sources that go from sort of being broad down to kind of specific targeted things. To use perhaps a cliche, almost like an iceberg, right, that it's big and wide at the top, but perhaps kind of shallow in depth. And then as we go down, it's maybe, becomes more specific and concentrated. But so cliches aside, I think really it you know, open source collection, I think, just relies fundamentally on a good understanding of, you know, Suraj has been citing a lot of local media sources, right? Understanding the media landscape that we're talking about here, you know, what are the sources coming out of Lebanon? You know, what are their political leanings? Are they kind of affiliated with certain kind of movements? And having just that as a basis to know, okay, so, you know, the perhaps Hezbollah supportive newspaper is reporting this. Okay, so now we can contextualize that report. It's not just, you know, source says X. Then I think it's kind of moving down, and perhaps that surface level as well, it's kind of also a good understanding of official sources, you know, like what are the government saying? What is the, you know, what's coming out of, you know, ministry websites about, you know, things like health stats, you know, casualty stats, etc. Then I think below that, it's perhaps the more targeted, looking at military specific sources, understanding the landscape of where perhaps, you know, in this example, like the IDF is publishing information on a lot of different platforms. You know, they use Telegram a lot. They're using WhatsApp to some extent as well. They have their own website. They have their own, you know, elements within their website. Casualties are published somewhere, you know, understanding where that is and kind of regularly visiting right. that, collecting it, structuring it. And then I think it's kind of on the flip side of that, and perhaps another level down, it's like it's getting into the militant affiliated media and understanding what they're putting out, what messaging they're conveying, you know, carefully monitoring that. In this case, you know, Hezbollah has one controlled media organization as well as affiliated ones. And then it's sort of perhaps the more gritty things, getting inside chat rooms, understanding, you know, Twitter and social media and sort of odd and specific bloggers or reporters that are you know, not easy to find in or not, you can't find them in the indexed internet. So, and then perhaps I think maybe sitting alongside that is lots of tangential data that's really helpful, that isn't necessarily, you know, topic specific, but is really helpful to color kind of what it is we're looking at. So, you know, we're looking at maybe even geospatial data sets that in themselves aren't necessarily relevant to, you know, military or militants or anything like that, but are helping us build you know, our analysis. So those figures that I've cited about 103 you know, distinct urban agglomerations, you know, that's coming from us finding data sets out in the internet as well that are able to sort of color our assessments and analysis that are not necessarily specific.
I think what I've heard in that excellent resume of what you're doing, Elliot, thank you, is three things. First of all, you need to know where the sources are and the context around those sources in terms of their affiliations, their motivations. And that's a non-trivial thing to understand the context. Secondly, you've talked about the multitude of different sources that we might need to go and collect, including, as you say, tangential ones that aren't necessarily immediately obvious. And three, underneath both of those and alongside it is that's not a short-term thing you just suddenly build overnight. This is a long-term endeavor. You get to understand it. And Suraj, I shall come back to you on this point. You know, how long have you been studying this territory, these organizations, the dynamics around them? Because I'm convinced that it's through that expertise you've built up over a long time, you can see things for what they're probably really trying to tell us. So how long have you been working on this kind of work, Suraj?
Oh, I'd say the last few years, about 3 to 4 years. But, you know, more recently with Hezbollah, it's been the last couple of years. And I think, you know, with the war that started in October, I've had a chance to, you know, learn about the group in a much more accelerated fashion, which might not have been possible otherwise, or rather, which would have taken me a slightly longer time. But, you know, what's going on every day with a lot lot going on every day. It forces you to be on your feet to identify and understand how the group reacts, in such tense times. And I think, like you mentioned, Harry, Elliot did a very good job in, sort of highlighting how we do our open source gathering and understanding of what's happening on the ground. And I just want to, I just want to highlight from my perspective, looking at Hezbollah as another aspect of open source gathering. I've said in this, in our conversation here that, there's been a 30% increase in Hezbollah claims and things like that. And the reason why I use Hezbollah claims as opposed to exact number of attacks is because that's very hard to ascertain. Hezbollah could claim a particular attack on Israeli security forces, and that attack could involve 20, 30, 40 rockets, maybe even 200, 300 rockets. It's going to be very hard to count the number of attacks, exactly. So sometimes you have to be, okay with dealing with the claims, which we've, recognize that Hezbollah does not, exaggerate too much. They exaggerate, their targets. They exaggerate, the IDF casualties. In fact, so far since October, Hezbollah has claimed that every single attack conducted by the group has hit its intended targets and caused appropriate casualties. But that's in fact not true. You have to be sometimes, you have to be okay with, we know that Hezbollah does not exaggerate a lot about their attack claims itself. If they say they've carried, if they claim an attack, that means they have more likely carried out the attack. And using that, we have to be, with the understanding of other aspects of the group, we have to be able to, assess what's happening and how the conflict is going on the ground.
Well, look, Jens, as time now does evaporate on us, three things I want to take away from this conversation. And before I start any of that, thank you both very, very much for your insights, and stand by for more requests to come back and do this again in a reasonably short period of time. I think what I take away from this conversation in three parts is as follows. This is a developing situation in southern Lebanon, and that there are definitely dynamics in play in terms of just how much degradation we've seen in terms of the Hezbollah forces. By the way, I've just realized we didn't talk at all about the, should we say, government of Lebanon, but we'll do that perhaps in the future conversation about how that might be a dynamic playing against Hezbollah within the borders. But again, we'll park that. So the first one is just how much degradation has actually gone on in terms of the hierarchy of the higher and the more tactical levels. Secondly, the aspirations of Israel in this unified conflict, which, it, as you said earlier, it sees as the same conflict. It just happens to be happening in more than one place now with multiple strategic and local players. Just how much it will, the country of Israel will seek to push that buffer further and further back. With 120 or so urban areas, that will be a non-trivial task, to say the least. So that'll be very interesting to watch. And then thirdly, the impact it's having on the populations among which it's happening, the hundreds of thousands of displaced people and the movements of those people perhaps from Lebanon back into Syria and so on. That's another dynamic here, which just we've seen in Gaza will undoubtedly play geopolitically and certainly strategically as that human cost starts to become a bigger and bigger play. So both of you, thank you again for helping me with this podcast. What we'll do again in a short period of time is revisit. And the kind of things I'm looking to revisit is, what have we learned about the degradation, the impact on the civilian population? What have we learned from where Israel is trying to get to in this overall conflict? And what is it that open source is telling us? That's the kind of thing this podcast is all about. So Elliot and Siraj, thank you both again very much for your support to this podcast. I will be inviting you back very shortly. And to our listener, thank you for taking the time to listen to us on this podcast. And as I've said before, please do write in. Let us know what you'd like to know more about. Or if you have any comments on what you've heard, very happy to have all the above. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on The World of Intelligence. Make sure to visit our website, janes.com/podcast, where you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode.